Hello, once again. Our chant ends with, may we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning. And the Tathagata is the one who has realized who has awakened, who knows, not knowing in the sense of knowledge of intellect, rational intellect, but the one who knows what truly is, the true nature of things. And knowing in this, this is a different kind of knowing, okay? So when we say, may we completely know it, completely realize what the true meaning is, we come back to the origin, as we talked yesterday, about how did we get here? How did the Buddha get the person who, Shakyamuni, how did he come to the point of realizing something and then transmitting it to others? And how did it come down to us then? And what was it that was realized and transmitted? Yesterday we said that he spoke with his former comrades, the people who he had practiced with before, and it was something different. They had never heard this before. And Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher, the great Japanese-American Zen who brought some of the basic Zen teachings to the West, used to say that Shakyamuni or a Zen master doesn't speak about Zazen or speak about awakening, but speaks from Zazen or from awakening, which is a big difference. So the words may be the same, but if they are about something, that's very different than if they're coming from something. So when the Buddha goes and talks to his friends, he's speaking from his realization. He's not speaking about it. And that's how the teachings, what we call the teachings, the practice, has been transmitted generation to generation, is not by speaking about, but speaking from experience of what is. Now the Zen tradition, which came about many centuries after the Buddha's life, and even everything that has been written, the sutras, like I said yesterday, where we found those five remembrances and the divine messengers, are taken from the sutras. Those were words that were written down after many, many centuries after the Buddha had actually spoken. We like to think that those words were written down from the experience of awakening, not about it. And mostly we can sense that it is speaking from, not about. Then when many, many, many centuries later, Zen comes about, is brought from India to China. One of our founding figures of the Zen tradition, Bodhidharma, brought a different approach to China. There already was traditional Buddhism in China, but he came and he said, this is a teaching outside of the sutras. So he was trying to tell people, get away from words about the practice, about awakening. And he said, it's outside the sutras, it's directly in the heart of us, of each one of us. That's where the teaching is. Because it had become really a lot of speaking about instead of speaking from. And his way of radically breaking from that speaking about was to speak from and explain from, so that people themselves could experience what was truly about the heart. And this is where the Zen tradition then starts branching from more traditional versions of Buddhism, because a lot of them stay, you know, they're really traditional Theravada schools that are really stay with the original ancient Buddhism teachings. Whereas the Zen tradition branched in a different direction. I wouldn't say branched from, but experienced it in a different way, let's say. A more direct way. And so we honor this, in the Zen tradition, we honor the Buddha's awakening in this way, of him awakening to, he that final night, when he sits through the night, all those hours, he drops everything. He lets go of all the stuff that he's been taught, all of the previous practices that he's done, all of the expectations, the ideas, everything he thinks that it should be, you know, even an end to suffering, whatever. He drops it all. And this is what then the Zen tradition inspires, is inspired from that of dropping everything. We sit down on our cushion and we just drop it. We let go of it. And Suzuki, again, Suzuki, I really like this. So he says, when we do not expect anything, we can become ourselves. Very simple, right? We can live fully in each moment of time. And when his definition of is when we sit, what in traditional Zen we call Zazen, it's just to receive the letter from the world of emptiness. So when we're not expecting anything, then we are truly who we are. That's who we truly are. No expectations. And we sit and we receive the letter, the message from emptiness, something like that. But this is not easy, right? To not expect anything. But we are inspired by the Buddha's example because he didn't expect anything. He just dropped it. He said, okay, I don't know, you know? Whatever it is, I will just sit here and see whatever arises. And in the stories, you know, all kinds of things come up. He's visited by all the dark sides of his soul, which take the form of Mara, who is, you know, all of the temptations and this black archetype who's, you know, questioning him, making him doubt, tempting him with, you know, all of the earthly comforts and the worldly delights. And he's just sitting. Just sitting. And this is our first example of just sitting in our tradition, okay? And So by that example, we see that he's not trying to escape from anything. In his previous practices, he was. You know, he was trying to escape from the worldly world and escape from all of the temptations and escape from anything that he thought would cause him suffering. Withdrawing from society, withdrawing from the world, leaving his wife and child, escaping. Whereas his example, when he has this long night of sitting, is that this practice is not about escaping, but it's about fully inhabiting our life as it is, fully being who we truly are. The question is, who are we truly, right? You know, what does that mean? And his expression of that, you know, was to see that he and all sentient beings throughout space and time were one. There was no separation. And they were all already awakened. There was no one even to save or be saved. Nothing to say, nowhere to go. It was all already here. In that sense, he discovers his true self, who he truly is. And we are inspired by that in our way. Is inspired by that. Of course, then throughout the centuries, there are all these rituals and forms and all of this stuff is added on. But that's not at all what the point is. The point is to just sit down, drop everything, and see what arises, to receive that letter from emptiness. Emptiness, another big loaded word. Okay, but emptiness is really just things as they are, without anything added on, without any separations, divisions, qualities, categories, appreciations, success, failure, before all of that. That's all that emptiness really is. So we sit there and we drop everything and we receive that letter. It's telling us this. So we could say, well, we have an expectation then while we're sitting there. We're waiting for this letter to arrive. Yeah. Well, we have to even let go of that expectation. We have to drop it. I'm just looking at my notes because I don't want to forget anything that I quickly made some notes before I arrived so that I could kind of follow something. But we sit. Our instructions are just to sit. So any of you who arrived here for the first time, you got very minimal instructions. You know, probably lasted 15 minutes or something. Which, on the one hand, it's not so great. On the other hand, it's absolutely wonderful because you just sit and you are left to experience all of this, experience wanting to know something, not knowing what to do, feeling uncomfortable, getting lost, looking around and saying, what are these people doing? Why am I here? But you're invited to discover it for yourself. Some Buddhist schools give really elaborate techniques and really powerful, like a Vipassana retreat, really, really powerful, sitting there for 10 days with this, intense practice. The Tibetan schools have all these elaborate teachings and mantras and archetypes and transmissions, and the masters talk for days, There's also something incredibly beautiful about that. It's a different approach. It's a different way. The Zen approach is take it all away. Throw it all away. Just sit. Right? Just sit here. Which, for me, is what my way is. Some other people, it's not their way. If you're sitting here, it may be your way. You know, there might be something here that resonates for you. If you're here for the first time, you might think, oh no, this is not my way. Get me out of here, you know. Or you might still think, I don't know, maybe I'll try something else. And it's good to do that. It's good to look around and find what is your way, you know, to test. Not test in the way to evaluate, but see what resonates for you, what feels, what appeals to you, what is your affinity. And it's not that, because I say this has been my way, it's not because it's better than another way at all. It's just that this is the one that speaks to me. My teacher, for example, is really, really has a great affinity with the Tibetan teachings. And before she came to Zen, she went to India, practiced with some of the most incredible masters, who at the time were not great masters. This was in the 70s. And she met all these teachers, you know, who have now become, you know, really great teachers you can't possibly get near, or they have died, you know. But then she met this Zen teacher, and something clicked. And that became her way, because of that connection with that teacher. My own story was that I didn't know anything about anything. Asked someone to show me how to do meditation. They showed me how to sit, and then I wanted to find other people who sat. And I met this teacher. But it really was not about Zen. It was about the connection with the teacher. And so, okay, this was what she did, so that's what I did. And the way that I do it is different than the way she does it, but still it's the same. She, like I said, is very influenced by the Tibetans, and so she talks a lot about Tibetan masters and teachings and phrases and poems and things like that, which I don't really have any affinity for. I understand it, but it's not my way, you know? At the same time, she and I are of one mind, and we both know it's just about sitting here and now with what is. Whatever you want to talk about, however you want to talk about it, present it, however you want to introduce it, it's still that. It's just that. Opening our heart to this here and now. So to come back to this, the self, right? So we have to look into the nature of the self in order to receive the letter from emptiness, in order to open to the universe. This is a key path, right? Who are you? Who is the self? What is the self? What is the true self, then? Because if we say there's no self, well, that doesn't really work, because we're talking about the true self. So it's not that there's no self. It's that the self is not who and what we think it is. So we have to look into, okay, so who is that self? What is that self? And the, you know, we sometimes say that, so human beings have invented some amazing things, right? Airplanes, computers, medicine that cures what have long been incurable diseases, television, film, photography, amazing paintings, you know, all this incredible stuff. The human mind has created, invented, created. However, none of those things have made the human being noble. And noble, not in the word of like an aristocrat, but noble from the, you know, the root, the etymology of that word noble is the same as gnosis. So it's G-N-O, that's the root, which is to know. That's the root of noble. It has been interpreted, you know, as someone, you know, an aristocrat or someone who is knowable, someone who is well known. But actually, if we go back to that root, the one who is noble is the one who knows. The one who knows their self, their true self. And so the Buddha talks about the noble truths. Those truths are from the one who knows, from that knowing, from that essential knowing of the true nature of being and of self. You know, the word noble, of course, is used very differently now, but it still has that notion of magnificent, splendid, I don't know, excellent something, but not in the sense of someone who's noble and then someone who is lower, you know, the aristocrats and then the people. It's not that. It's when we talk about noble in this context, it's the noble of the one who knows, the one who is not deluded. And delusion, you know, really in the Sanskrit and the Pali words, means no light. So it's what is not in the light. That's why we say enlightenment. We could say delusion is endarkenment. It's being in the dark, right? So this amazing simple practice of just sitting, can you say it's a human invention? Well, in a sense it is. It's been developed by humans. Makes humans noble. Computers don't do that. Smartphones don't do that. Airplanes don't do that. Trains don't do that. You know, machines that wash clothing and cook food and heat houses, they don't do that. Medicine that heals doesn't really make us noble. The medicine that heals is this practice. It heals our basic wound of separation, being separate from what is, separate from others. There was something about separation. What was it? About the, oh yeah, I know what it was. That, so when humans, we can probably look at the animals and see if they do it too, but humans start conflicts with each other because of egocentric discrimination, right? So egocentric being an attachment to self, to an idea of self. And when humans awaken and become noble, they don't do that anymore, okay? Because they know. But so this conflict that we start, whether it's just I want more food than you, or I want the piece of clothing you have, or I don't want you to live in my territory, I don't like you because you don't look like me, you don't speak my language, I want part of your land, your land, my land, all of these human egocentric discriminations we make is how we give rise to conflict. And it's all based on this not being one with the self. And in it's interesting because, and I may have talked about this before, but in Christianity, we have, you know, the sins, the original sins, the original sin, right? You know, so Adam and Eve, enter the intellect, take, start basing their life from intellect instead of heart, we could say. This is a Zen interpretation, of course, but would probably be considered heresy in the church, but not really, because the origin is that, okay, and then they have to hide them, they have to cover themselves, right? Because they have entered the intellect. And hiding yourself arises from separation. Because if you're not separate, there's nothing to hide, you know? And separation is the source of all evil, then, of the original sins. We know that in our practice, that separation is the cause of so much pain and suffering. If we say evil, that's, you know, a real judgment. But, you know, we inflict so much pain on one another and on ourselves coming from this place of separation and not seeing who we truly are in the unity of one, us and the other and all things. Now, animals, I don't know so much, because, you know, the animal kingdom operates differently. Of course, they don't have the same human intellect that we have, so they don't, their consciousness functions differently, and the way they work together and live together is different. And, of course, they have territories. I have had an experience this summer with my cats, who, I live in the city, but I have a small enclosed garden, and my cats roam in the garden, and they also go over the walls and roam in the neighborhood as the other cats do. But, you know, the cats pretty much respect each other's territory. So if another cat enters the territory of my cats, and my cats also think that the neighbor's garden is their territory too, because there's no cats and they go there all the time, it's the Zen Center, which is next door, and they know everyone there and they go there too. So, but if other cats come into their territory, well, one of my cats, the other one is afraid, but one of them makes it clear that those other cats should get out, right? And the other cats know that they shouldn't be there. And they know that they're transgressing if they come into this garden, right? So they leave. And there's not usually much fighting, it's just a lot of noise, but they go. So this summer, when it was just unbearably hot, heat wave in Paris, you know, 40 degrees for days and days, which is very unusual in Paris, in the city especially, there was this cat that had been coming around for a few weeks that we hadn't seen before. And my cat chased her away all the time. And so in order to avoid conflict, when we would see that cat, we would sometimes, if my husband was out watering the lawn or something, he would spray some water on the cat so she would go away. And so one day, one morning, when it had been hot for days, this small cat came into our garden and brought baby kittens into the garden and sat there. And my cats stayed about 3 or 4 meters away and just watched, just looked at her, at this cat and those kittens. We were stunned. We didn't know what to do. But it became clear that this was a desperate appeal for help. And this mother cat knew that there were humans there, of course, and was appealing to us, although this is a stray city cat who doesn't really want anything with humans. And so I gave her a plate of food. Of course, she ran away, but I put a plate of food and a bowl of water there for her and called desperately this association in my town that takes care of stray cats and things like that. They didn't answer. So I sent an email saying, we called the vet, you know, we called different people who told us to contact that association. Sent an email, and in the subject line of the email, I put mother cat in distress with baby kittens. That was the subject line. So, and with my phone number and everything. And within a half an hour, they called me. And they said, the reason we opened that email was because you had said cat in distress with baby kittens. So they came. So she said, can you keep them in the garden? Well, I can't really keep the cat in the garden, but, you know, I said, I'll keep an eye out. So, and they came, the women came within an hour, and she managed to first catch the mother cat in this big sort of box cage type thing. She managed to get her in by offering her food. And then once she had the mother cat, it was easy to get the kittens. They were probably only a month, 6 weeks old. And was going to take them and treat them and sterilize the mother cat. And if no one wanted to take the cats, of course, people would want the kitten. But if they didn't want the mother cat, she said she would bring it back because she had to put her back in the habitat that she was familiar with. So not necessarily in our garden, but in our neighborhood. The whole story being that the cats, my cats, didn't drive that mother cat away when they sensed that this was something different, you know. Humans don't do that. Humans kill children, they starve people, they don't care if people are pregnant or whatever. Humans, it's my territory, get out. Or we want your territory, go away. The cats didn't do that. The cats knew somehow. So humans, you see, we have a problem. And we can awaken and become noble, like the animals, you know? We think the animals aren't noble, but in a sense, animals are very noble. They know what they know. They know who they are. Not in the same way that we do, and they don't have the same consciousness, so it's not the same kind of awakening, but they're already awakened, in a sense, the animals, to things as they are, you know? So you know, we also know that our self that we're attached to is involved with being seen, being better, accumulating, accomplishing, arriving. We know all that. That's the world we are so familiar with. And then feeling not good enough, or being jealous, or disliking, or grasping. We know all of this. This is so familiar. However, the true self, who you truly are, that self is beyond success and failure. And it's not even that it's beyond, it's that it sees through what is success and failure and what that is about, you know. And it sees that that is just an illusion that belongs to the self who is also an illusion. The true self, the noble self, knows that. And so is not involved with success and failure. And if we can, when we sit on our cushions and practice this practice that leads us to being noble, or that makes us noble, actually when we sit, we are already expressing the true self that is noble. We're not aware of it, but we are. And that we're no longer engaging in success and failure, although we are in the sense that we're thinking, oh, I really want to arrive somewhere, I really want to do this, I'm not doing this well, or I'm doing this so perfectly. I'm the best meditator in the room. You know? Probably no one's really feeling that, but that can arise, you know. and I know so much more than everybody else, and I want them to know that, I want them to see me, I'm going to tell them how to do it. You know, sometimes with the positions in the retreat like this, with the timekeeper, the chant leader, the cook, the work leader, nobody wants to volunteer for those positions, right? Everybody wants to just do their own thing. But then as soon as someone else does it, everybody becomes an expert and tells them how to do it. You know, this is really common. Tells them, oh, you should really ring the bell this way, or you're not doing it the right way. But that person who's telling you didn't want to do it, right? So that's when we can see that even in this context, we engage in this self who success and failure. Wanting, not wanting, clinging, you know, we chant in our chant, because we desire the natural order of mind to be free from clinging. So already this desire we're clinging to not cling, in a sense. But not really. So we say then we should be free from greed. So can we look at our greed? Can we look at what it is that we want so bad? And that we want to accumulate and not share with anyone else. If we can look into that, then our mind will be free from clinging. Naturally, it is. The natural order of mind is free from clinging. But we have added on clinging to the natural order. And so, you know, in a sense, we could say that the true self is like the sky, in the sense of it has no, you know, if you look up at the sky, it has no pattern, the sky. It has nothing to hang on to. There are clouds that pass, and all the clouds are different. Different sizes, different colors, different moments. They're moving, the clouds, too. Although, you know, like today, it looks like they're not. But, you know, an hour ago, it was sunny out there. So the clouds had moved to some extent, at least partially. It's not static. And the sky is, you know, boundless. There's no limit to the sky. It's infinite. Your true self is as well. It has no limits. It has no container. It has no pattern. And there was a that's another story I read. I think it's from another Zen master, Uchiyama, who said that he, when he was a child in Japan, there used to be a guy who, in the marketplace, played a mandolin or something, and had like a blanket over his shoulder or something. He was kind of an eccentric artist who played in the marketplace. But he had a sign that he wore that said, "Look up at the sky every day, once a day," or something like that. And as a child, he found this really intriguing, the Zen master. He thought it was really fascinating, but he didn't do it until he had become a great Zen master and had been head of a monastery, a big monastery in Japan. And then he retired and moved out into the countryside, up a mountain or something, to lead kind of a hermit's life. And then he started, oh no, he moved to a different town, I think, a different city. On a river. And so then he started this practice where he would walk along the river on paths where there weren't cars for an hour and a half every day, looking at the sky. And I said, it was just a fabulous experience. And this is someone who had practiced Zen, become a Zen master, head of a monastery, and all of this stuff, and he had never looked at the sky. And he saw the connection then between, I don't think he used the same words I'm using, but the sky has no pattern, like the the self, the true self. Of course, this true self manifests in this way, but it's just another manifestation, like another cloud, that this is, the sky. The true self is just manifesting as this, but that's not who we are, okay? It's not limited to this, something like that. I'm just looking to see if I forgot anything. So that, just to come back to the Buddha's original moment, it's interesting that Buddha, you know, awakens when he looks up to the sky, too. He raises his eyes and he sees that morning star looking at the sky. And there are practices, you know, like the Dzogchen tradition, they have this practice of sky gazing. And that's what their whole practice is just gazing at the sky.
What practice?
Dzogchen, the Tibetan. It's a Tibetan school that's very close, the teaching is very close to Zen. And for many, many, many centuries, it was considered a secret. You know, reserved only for people who had were really far advanced. But now in the West, in the past 30 years, there are lots of Tibetan masters who are teaching Dzogchen because there was no reason to keep it secret anymore. You know? And part of their practice is sky gazing. And you know, like when in our summer retreats, when we sit outside at night, that's also a practice of sky gazing. Of if we have a view of the sky, which we usually do, or last summer, and again this summer, because this summer we will again be in the same place, we sat on the beach at night. And that was a fabulous practice of sky, ocean, horizon gazing, which is this. Same as, you know, the ocean has no pattern. If you try to establish some pattern to those waves, good luck. You know, we do, you know, humans have watched the moon, watched how the ocean changes when the tide comes in, when it goes out, but even that is ungraspable. You know, you don't know really how that will be. It's moving, it escapes our grasp, just like the true self. So the Buddha's awakening was to see that. And to see that, you know, the something like, the only thing that the intellectual, discursive mind needs to know is that it is incapable of knowing the self. Of course, it doesn't want to know that because it makes it not important. And all, you know, the koan practice is designed to destroy the intellect, the rational mind, okay? Of course, it only destroys it in this context. The rational mind and the intellect is fabulous, you know? It discovers cures to grave diseases. It builds airplanes. It builds computers. It does all kinds of wonderful things, you know? Makes fabulous art. Allows us to function together in a peaceful way because we haven't realized who we truly are. It also, though, creates the possibility for us to destroy each other with our great inventions. You know, and like I say, the atomic bomb came about from separation. The separation of the atom gave us this weapon, this power to destroy ourselves. Crazy, isn't it? I mean, we're just this crazy animal, the humans. But so the Buddha, you know, with his what he realized 2,500, 600 years ago tomorrow, tomorrow morning, or actually, I don't know, yeah, I think it was tomorrow morning, actually, the morning of the ape, what he realized was how we can be true and live not about something, but from something. So live from love, let's say, because the whole thing is about love, something like that. And of course, many other great spiritual traditions have said the same thing. Christ, that was his message as well. You know, the great mystics, the Sufis, the Jewish mystics. Usually, it's expressed by the mystics because they know and they don't, you know, they have this noble awareness and they don't get caught by the doctrines and the schools and all the human creations that limit. The mystics are free of that, and that's why they express love in that way, and that's why they express this returning to the true self, like the Buddha did. So I think maybe I will stop with all of that now, and you can share what you would like to or ask questions. Yeah, that's good.
Just a sharing. What you were saying is it comes completely in the direction of what I was feeling just when we were sitting. Because I was just gazing, attentive, whatever, and sensing the sense of I not wanting to just drop, just persisting, and so seeing that game. And at some point I realized that I was naked, not my yesterday I said, she asked me, what is that? I said, oh, it's kind of symbolic mini robe. And so it's about, I'm naked, I really felt naked. So at the same time, there's this vulnerability of being naked and this presence of kind of being held by I love, yeah. And so it was this at the same time the feeling of vulnerability, of even resisting to just plunge into the unknown, not knowing, and at the same the presence of it. It's so, but when you start to speak about this, it's
yeah, and like so that's like a symbolic being naked, but actually that's yeah. That's where we need to go. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the sense that you really need to be naked to enter into not knowing. It was a bit that sense. Yeah.
Hmm. And for those of us who wear these rakusus all the time, it's quite extraordinary when we forget it. You know, I know myself. Not so long ago, we had a day of practice in Paris. And I arrived at the place, And I realized I hadn't brought my rugs. And so I sat the whole day without it, and it was a really powerful experience to sit without it and see where my attachments to it were, or my habit of this is what it feels like when I sit, and so without it, very powerful moment.
Just to share, and I did experience exactly the contrary, because for 2 or 3 months I didn't practice the formal. I didn't see it. I have my justice. I decided, and to come to this retreat, the first thing I pick up for my bag was the rakusu, and when I put it the first time to say hello, friend, it's exactly the other thing. Hello, friend, here we are. It's the rakusu. It really works very powerfully in our practice.
And what's the difference of sitting with a rakusu
or not?
Not?
Yeah. Yeah, I think probably for each person it's different. My experience that day when I sat with it was, so I looked at all of my attachments around it, and what was I saying by not wearing it, and what did that mean, how did I feel about it, and I felt so free, actually.
So? Free.
Free, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So free that really, I mean, that this was not what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my talk probably was even about that, I don't know. And I'm someone who really, in the beginning of my practice, thought this was ridiculous, that I had no need for this. Why did these people wear that thing? Really, no need for it. And then at some point, I had a shift, and I was like, well, it's not so much why wear it, it's like why not wear it, which was a really important shift for me. So then this, you know, to shift it again was to like, I don't have it. What? And it was liberating, really liberating.
Yeah, the best experience is really to lose it.
Mm-hmm. And you could speak from that, yeah.
And it was really quite an experience, I'd say, because it was very ambivalent at some time. I really realized that I was attached to the thing. And then even we changed some emails. I think they were emails at that time. And I remember perfectly you said it's just a piece of cloth. And it was very liberating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was very good.
Yeah, that
but
was...
of course, I mean, it's not so much the cloth itself or the rakusu, it's the meaning that, like, if you lose a ring that was very precious and coming from a family or member, and it's not really the value of the gold or something, is
exactly
the affection. Or so it's that was very ambivalent, but it was quite an experience. I was out of my mind for a long time. And it was really nice to check what is going around. What is the meaning of this? Because I knew at the same time, very rationally, that, yeah, it's a piece of cloth. And it's nothing else than that. Of course, in my case, it was different from all of you, because you have...
Made
you have
it.
The long effort to get it, whereas I was lucky to just be offered with that thing. And but I can imagine that all of a sudden came into my mind that this can become crazy. The other day I saw this cardinal, this American guy called Burke. I don't know if you have heard about him. It's a very reactionary, conservative Catholic cardinal. Yeah, because he's so reactionary and so conservative, and I think out of provocation, he really wants to wear this very big red cloak, that Catholics have. It's absolutely unimaginable. I mean, I think he's the only cardinal who does that, but I think he's to provoke as well. He wants to say, I am a cardinal as it should be. So I just got some images where the guy is ridiculous, walking around with a very long tail, but it's like 10 or 15 meters, you see. And then you have people hanging it, the guy is going around. It's the absolute contrary of what a spiritual guy should be. He's really his ego there. I'm here as representing the Catholic Church. But I saw that, I can show you afterwards. It's in a way, it's this attachment to symbols and to power,
exactly,
in a sense.
And that's what happens when we become attached to the forms and the rituals. And so, you know, in the case of people here who have their rakusus, unlike José Eduardo, who his teacher gave him that rakusu, so it's very important. These, the ones here, it's because when they take the vows to, you know, formally acknowledge that their life is the awakened way, that they are already that and they want to pursue that and deepen that, then they make a rakusu and there's a ceremony and they receive a dharma name with it. And so it has different, it doesn't mean that one is better than the other, the symbolism and the meaning is just different. And so as soon as we become attached to the thing instead of what it represents or what it means to us, then, you know, like the red robe of the cardinal. I mean, I don't even know what the origin of that red robe is, but, you know.
Yeah, but it's crazy. I mean, it's really,
yeah.
I don't know, 20 meters long. Yeah. And the guy looks like a peacock and is going around. And it's so crazy.
Yeah.
It's an extreme example. That's nothing to do with St. Francis, of course.
No. Well, and then people can become attached to what Francis did and copy that and think that that's the only way too, you know? It's like, that's why the beauty of the Zen practice is that, okay, we have this ritual that and all these forms we do, but everyone has to realize it for themselves. I guess I shouldn't say just Zen from Buddhism, because that's what the Buddha's realization was too, that we have to each find it for ourselves.
Thank you for the wonderful talk. My great difficulty regarding Zen practice is not to be taught, as you said, just to sit, because and that's the really huge challenge, is to be seated looking for something that I don't know what it is, which is myself, of course, but I've been trying to meditate for a long, long time. I've been searching for many ways to find myself, yoga, and last few months I discovered that be seated will be the best way to find it, just to be quiet and seated. But the really huge challenge is not to have a teacher, which is really probably my intellectual mind that is ruling my way of seeing it. Well, to be here was wonderful because I discovered that that's the way, in fact. But still, that's the how can I be free of that need to find some intellectual frame that helps me to arrive the place I want to arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the huge challenge. I know that I need to be seated because I need to be quiet and to be peaceful to find it. But for me, for example, it's very important to hear your talks because it's somehow a guide, a guideline, but not to have a book that I can follow. It's really the huge challenge that I'm facing at the moment. Well, this is my... I wanted to share this with you because it's really I think that, well, intellectual minds probably have this challenge in a more challenging way, because we need to have a reasonable frame to guide us. But that's a real problem, because I don't arrive to my true self or to my heart with that path. I know I don't do it, but still.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure everyone can relate to this to some extent. It's the same challenge for everybody,
mm-hmm.
in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone wants to. On the one hand, we want to be told what to do, and on the other hand, we don't want anybody to tell us what to do. So it's both. And the thing is that, so yes, the intellect and the rational mind can be greatly enriched by books and knowledge, book knowledge, things like that. That's how it knows and understands the world. Whereas the heart just knows. It doesn't need any of that. But we become so preoccupied with this part, and so I'm using, the head and the heart, but in the Oriental, in the Chinese and the Japanese, it's one word, shin. It's what we don't have a word for it. It's heart mind, because that is the one who knows, not the intellect. The intellect knows a lot of things, but the one who knows truly is the heart, and it's a huge challenge, as you say. You also mentioned a teacher, because that in the Zen tradition, you have to have a teacher. That's really how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike, say, the Tibetans, where they also have, they say you need a teacher, but like the Tibetan, which is the complete opposite, there's like thousands of people who come to hear the teacher, but you don't really have a personal relationship with the teacher,
mm-hmm.
Unless you're Matthieu Ricard, or someone.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you don't, or Richard Gere, otherwise you don't have a personal relationship with personal, impersonal relationship, It's not like you're going out to dinner together and you're best friends and whatever. But you have this personal, impersonal relationship with the teacher. The Theravadins, they don't really focus on the teacher so much. There are teachers, but that's not the important thing. Zen, it's the absolute essential aspect is having the teacher and having a relationship with the teacher. Because, and it has to be a living teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take a statue as your teacher, we like to say, well, you'll become a statue. So you need a living human being who embodies what this is about, so that is what you then will be as well. And the teacher can't lead you anywhere, but can give you indications. Having gone along the path before you, can say, okay, watch out, here it's bumpy, there it's a sharp cliff, this way is smoother, watch out for falling rocks, The teacher has been on that path ahead, or is walking the same path, but is a few steps ahead, and therefore can indicate and help guide, accompany you on that path. But yeah, I know that when I first met my teacher, the first thing I said was, okay, what book can I read? And she said, no books. No books. And I was, I was very involved in the life of the intellectual mind. I was a writer and a journalist, and that's how I functioned. I wanted to read a book. And so finally, I was so insistent, she said, okay, you can read this book. It's by my teacher, and it just was published. And it was a really good suggestion, because it wasn't an intellectual book.
Mm-hmm.
It was really like a Dharma talk, that kind of thing. But then after that, she said, no, don't read any books. And I didn't. I really followed that. Because then you have a better chance of, you're already so involved with this intellect, that if we feed the intellect with more, it's just more we have to let go of. And somewhere intuitively, you know that. like you say, you know, that's not what it is. And that's the heart that knows that. So trust that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Which is this quote from Nisargadatta? To study the self?
It is the one. You're saying the mind creates...
No. To study the self is...
That's Dogen.
Dogen, okay.
To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self.
Mm-hmm.
To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. Because you're no longer focused on one. Suddenly there's, the sky is the limit, you know. But Nisargadatta is a good one too, of when we look inside and see that we are no one, that's wisdom. When we look outside and see that we are everything, that's love.
Mm-hmm.
Between those two is where our heart turns. If we only stay with the wisdom, we're missing everything. If we only stay with the everything, we miss the nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We miss the...
Mm-hmm.
I think we are about out of time here. Yes. So I guess we